Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Nimitz by E.B. Potter, narrated by Mike Chamberlain. Preface. Fleet Admiral Nimitz's almost obsessive discretion may have had its roots in the notorious Samson Sly controversy, which was going on while Nimitz was a student at the Naval Academy. The controversy embarrassed friends of the Navy and permanently injured the reputations of both Rear Admiral William T. Sampson and Commodore Winfield S. Sly. Young Nimitz, shocked by the undignified bickering, vowed to himself that there would be no more such washing of the Navy's dirty linen in public if ever he was in a position to prevent it. During the rest of his life, he avoided and, insofar as possible, forestalled public controversy, particularly where it involved personalities. He made every effort to protect the feelings and reputations of his subordinates, even when they failed to measure up. Admiral Nimitz deplored the rushing into print of many World War II officers, particularly when their revelations tended to dim the prestige of other officers or to stimulate public wrangling. For his own part, he would not write his biography or permit it to be written during his lifetime, and even in his personal letters, he carefully withheld censure and all facts on which censure might conceivably be based. There was one exception. In his daily wartime letters to his wife, he freely let off steam, expressing his exasperation at the conduct or shortcomings of some of his associates. She understood that these comments were for her eyes only. It was just sort of a safety valve for him to do this, she said. To ensure that the contents of the letters should never be made public, she burned all except a few of the blandest. To his friend Andrew Hamilton, Admiral Nimitz said, "People ask me why I haven't written my memoirs. My answer has always been that history is best written by the professional historians. A wartime military commander is likely to be too emotionally involved to present an objective picture of himself or his associates, and his prejudices might hurt the people he served with." For the use of his future biographer, Nimitz carefully collected his papers and saw that they were deposited in the operational archives of the Naval History Division in Washington, D.C., under the care of Rear Admiral Ernest M. Eller, then Director of Naval History. In January 1965, he submitted to two long interviews by John T. Mason, Jr., representing the Columbia University Oral History Project, but he would not permit his replies to be recorded on tape. Mason made copious notes, then rushed to his hotel and reproduced the interviews as completely as possible on his tape recorder. Not long after Admiral Nimitz's death in 1966, Admiral Eller interested the eminent historian Alan Nevins in writing the Nimitz biography. Nevins had begun his research and engaged C.M. Nelson as his research assistant when he was stricken with an illness from which he did not recover. In 1969, the U.S. Naval Institute established its own oral history program with John Mason at its head. Mason took as his first project the collecting of more materials for Nimitz's biographer, whoever he might be. He began by interviewing Chester Nimitz, Jr. and his wife Joan at their home in Connecticut. Chester, Jr. expressed the opinion that the time was ripe for a biography of his father, but told Mason that his mother, Mrs. Chester Nimitz, Sr., was the one to give the green light for such a work. Mrs. Nimitz, Sr., then living in San Francisco, readily granted Mason a series of interviews. She told him that she wanted the biography written and that she would like Professor Potter to write it. "He knew the Admiral," she said. "Professor Potter worked with him, and he has been a guest in our home. I think that's important." The rest of the family agreed with Mrs. Nimitz. All granted extensive interviews, which were recorded on tape, transcribed, and submitted to the interviewees for correction. Mason and his assistant, Etta Bell Kitchen, then traveled to various parts of the United States and even abroad to interview former associates of Admiral Nimitz. Unfortunately, by 1969, some of the senior officers who had been most closely associated with Nimitz in World War II were dead, and others were too ill to be interviewed. I learned of these proceedings shortly after Mason's visit with Mrs. Nimitz. Commander R.T.E. Bowler, Jr., Secretary-Treasurer and Publisher, U.S. Naval Institute, invited me to his office and offered me a contract to write a biography of Admiral Nimitz. I promptly accepted the offer and signed the contract early in 1970. I caught my first glimpse of Admiral Nimitz in 1943 when I was on duty as a Naval Reserve officer at Pearl Harbor. He was riding by in the back seat of a big black car. Later the same year, I heard him address the personnel of the 14th Naval District. I was, at that time, working in the vault-like basement of the District Administration Building. This was the basement described at the beginning of Chapter 5 of this book, though by 1943 it was being used for distributing codes rather than breaking them. After the war, I was surprised and delighted to receive a letter from Admiral Nimitz congratulating me on a recently published book of which I was editor and chief author. I first spoke to him in 1955, when he attended the 50th anniversary homecoming of his Naval Academy class. I made my first visit to his home, Longview, in Berkeley, California, early in 1957, to discuss with him the writing of Sea Power, a Naval History, for which he had agreed to act as advisor and associate editor. During the next 2 years, the Admiral and I corresponded regularly concerning the book, and we conferred during his visits to the East Coast. In the summer of 1959, as the book was nearing completion, Admiral and Mrs. Nimitz invited my wife and me to stay with them during the final discussions. As we were leaving Longview, I told Admiral Nimitz that if ever he wanted somebody to write his biography, I hoped he would think of me. He smiled and said, "You know where my papers are." In March 1963, Commander Bowler wrote to the Admiral and asked if I might begin writing his life story for publication by the Naval Institute. Nimitz declined, indicating that he thought the time was not ripe. He was then considering having his children write the book after his death. Nevertheless, from time to time, he sent me papers and articles that would be useful to a biographer, and I filed them away. When Admiral Nimitz died in 1966, I used these materials to write a 10,000-word sketch of his life for publication in the U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings. After I had signed the contract for the Nimitz biography and had absorbed and cataloged the scores of interviews that Mason and his assistants had recorded, I flew with my wife to Texas, where I did some interviewing of my own among Nimitz's friends and relatives in Fredericksburg and Kerrville, where the Admiral was born and reared. We then went on to the West Coast for more interviews, including two final tape recordings with Mrs. Nimitz. In the course of writing this book, while also teaching history at the Naval Academy, I have been encouraged and assisted by the Navy Department and by the Nimitz family. Whenever I needed a detail that I could not find for myself, I wrote to whichever Nimitz was most likely to know the answer and always received a prompt reply. I did not, however, submit this book before publication either to the Navy Department or to the Nimitz family. It is proper that I alone be responsible for what is presented here. The Nimitzes and my naval friends understand and approve of this view. E.B. Potter, History Department, United States Naval Academy, August 1975. Chapter 1. The Appointment. In World War II, Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz commanded thousands of ships and aircraft and millions of men, amounting to more military power than had been wielded by all the commanders in all previous wars. The operations he directed and, to a large extent, devised, involved projecting across the Pacific Ocean forces that blasted Japan and defeated an enormously expanded Japanese empire. Admiral Nimitz was link and buffer between imperious, often caustic Admiral Ernest J. King, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet, and his own subordinates, men of stubborn convictions, usually expressed in emphatic language. The press aptly nicknamed three of them Bull Halsey, Terrible Turner, and Howling Mad Smith. Nimitz molded these strong-willed men, and others like them, into one of the most effective fighting teams in history. His success derived in part from a remarkable knack for anticipating events. This ability is illustrated in a forecast he made in the mid-1930s in a conversation with his son, then a midshipman at the U.S. Naval Academy. Chester Jr. put the question, "Pop, where do you expect to get in the Navy, and how do you expect to get there?" His father replied that he would like someday to be Chief of Naval Operations, the Navy's topmost professional command. As to how he hoped to get there, he intended to do his best as he had in the past, and was convinced that in the Navy, one got what one deserved. Of course, chance and timing played their part. "Let me say one thing," continued the elder Nimitz. "I do believe that we are going to have a major war with Japan and Germany, and that the war is going to start by a very serious surprise attack and defeat of U.S. armed forces, and that there is going to be a major revulsion on the part of the political power in Washington against all those in command at sea, and they're all going to be thrown out, though it won't be their fault necessarily. And I wish to be in a position of sufficient prominence so that I will then be considered as one to be sent to sea, because that appears to be the route." Some 3 years later, Nimitz, then a rear admiral, attained his position of sufficient prominence. Following a tour of sea duty, he reported in August 1939 to the Navy Department to serve as Chief of the Bureau of Navigation, as the Bureau of Naval Personnel was called at that time. He was 54 years old, trim and vigorous, with a pink complexion and light blonde hair just turning white. The position, though high level indeed, was a desk job, and, as such, did not entirely please him. He would have preferred to remain in command of forces at sea. Moreover, he disliked living and working in Washington, D.C. The post, however, concerned as it was with the procurement, training, promotion, assignment, and discipline of officers and enlisted personnel in the Navy, made good use of Nimitz's skills and interests. The training function, of particular concern to him, gave him general jurisdiction over the Naval Academy, over the Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps, of which he was a founder, over the officer candidate schools, and over all the boot camps and other training facilities in the Navy. In retrospect, Chester Jr. considered that the post had been ideal for his father. Said he, "Dad was a people man entirely. Bureau of Navigation. Dad never heard of the Bureau of Ordnance. He really wasn't interested in the guns and technology of the Navy." In fact, of course, as a young officer, Nimitz had been much involved with naval technology and tactics. He was a recognized authority on submarines and marine diesel engines. Later, he was instrumental in introducing into the Navy such technological improvements as underway replenishment and the circular formation. Chester Jr. regarded those achievements as far less important to his father's career than his tours as assistant chief and chief of the Bureau of Navigation and his earlier duty as assistant chief of staff to the Commander-in-Chief U.S. Fleet. He said, "The rest of the jobs, his submarine duties and so forth, were simply, so far as I'm concerned, familiarization with the mechanics of the seagoing Navy, but didn't tend to fit you for higher command. You didn't see much of the broad picture, as you do in the sink staff and in the Bureau of Navigation trying to man the Navy. So far as those in which he learned most, and in which the evaluation of his superiors was probably most critical to his subsequent success, I'd say those were the jobs." Admiral Nimitz took over as chief of the Bureau with little fanfare, but his presence was soon felt. At first, there was nothing specific, only a kind of invigorating appreciation of a big task ahead that had to be performed superbly well. Later, more specific things began to happen. Lines of communication became more direct, archaic processes were abandoned or simplified. Reorganization was, of course, necessary to meet new demands. A Congressional Act of 1934 had authorized building the fleet up to treaty strength. A second act in 1938 appropriated $1 billion for a two-ocean navy. Obviously, commanding, manning, and servicing all these new warships and their supporting bases was far beyond the capacity of the regular navy. Great numbers of men, and later of women, would have to be brought into the navy from the civilian population and trained as reservists to take over most of the assignments. The outbreak of war in Europe in 1939, with the possibility that the United States might be drawn in, made the rapid expansion of all naval training programs the more urgent. This expansion was the responsibility mainly of the Bureau of Navigation. The Bureau's training program soon ran afoul of plans drawn up by the Bureau of Aeronautics, which believed that it should control the training of the Navy's aviators and make important command assignments in naval aviation. All training and assignment had, of course, been the responsibility of the Bureau of Navigation, long before the Bureau of Aeronautics came into existence. Inevitably, the friction between the bureaus led to a confrontation between Rear Admiral Nimitz and Rear Admiral John H. Towers, chief of Buair. Each respected the other's abilities, but Towers regarded Nimitz, no aviator, as a battleship admiral, the best, perhaps, of the old school that had been made obsolescent by the aircraft carrier and by aviation in general. Being reasonable men, they reached a workable compromise. Towers seems to have been surprised by Nimitz's flexibility and understanding of the aviator's point of view. Each remained somewhat wary of the other, however, and each continued a gentlemanly campaign against the other's plans and ideas. As the Navy began to expand, Admiral Nimitz made the wise decision that the reservists should wear uniforms identical with those of the regulars. That decision was not popular among some of the professionals, but Nimitz stuck to it, despite the example of Britain's Royal Navy, in which reserve officers wore undulating gold stripes, from which they got the nickname Wavy Navy. Nimitz saw in such differentiation a real handicap. It marked the reservists as different from and somehow inferior to the regulars, whereas regulars and reservists would, for the most part, have the same authority and the same responsibilities. Difference in uniform implied a lack of unity that did not or should not exist. The Bureau of Navigation was rapidly outgrowing its assigned space in Maine Navy, a building on Constitution Avenue constructed to house the Navy Department in World War I. A temporary building, it continued in use through World War II and long beyond. To find room for its growing secretariat, the Bureau began moving to a Navy Department annex in Arlington, a building it was to share with Marine Corps headquarters. The move imposed a hardship on Nimitz, who had to keep in close touch with the Secretary of the Navy and the Chief of Naval Operations while supervising his own bureau, part of which was housed on the far side of the Potomac River. Nimitz was also regularly in touch with the White House. President Franklin D. Roosevelt personally selected his top naval commanders, and he relied on advice from Nimitz, who was acquainted with every senior officer in the Navy and knew the special qualifications of each. Between the two men, there developed a curious bond. Nimitz deeply respected Roosevelt as president and recognized his political genius. At the same time, he was somewhat repelled by the feeling that Roosevelt was less than natural, that he was always playing a role. Roosevelt, on the other hand, seems unqualifiedly to have admired Nimitz. Early in 1941, the presidential favor brought Nimitz an extraordinary offer, nothing less than the post of Commander-in-Chief, U.S. Fleet, CINCUS. For so relatively junior an admiral to be offered the command second only to Chief of Naval Operations, CNO, was such a signal honor that it perhaps invites some background explanation. At the time of the offer, the war that Nimitz had predicted had already broken out in Europe. The Germans had annexed Austria and most of Czechoslovakia and had overrun Poland, Denmark, Norway, Holland, Belgium, and France. In the Orient, the Japanese, in an undeclared war, had invaded China and occupied northern Indochina. The United States was expanding its patrol force in preparation to assist beleaguered Britain by escorting convoys as far as Iceland. Americans were forbidden to sell aircraft, aviation gasoline, iron, or steel to Japan. In 1939, on President Roosevelt's orders, Admiral Claude C. Block, then CINCUS, began shifting his lighter vessels from their west coast ports to Pearl Harbor. In April 1940, Block's successor, Admiral James O. Richardson, completed the transfer of the U.S. fleet to Hawaii. Shortly afterward, the CNO, Admiral Harold R. Stark, notified Richardson that the fleet would be based on Pearl Harbor indefinitely. "Why are we here?" asked Richardson in some dismay. "You are there," replied Stark, "because of the deterrent effect which it is thought your presence may have on the Japs going into the East Indies." To Richardson, such reasoning was nonsense. He considered Japanese expansion in Asia and the Indies to be of slight concern to the United States. Anyway, he believed that a fleet kept in readiness in mainland ports was a more credible deterrent than one half-starved at the then-primitive Hawaiian base. He rushed the construction of facilities and housing at Pearl Harbor, but continued to complain. Twice he visited Washington to urge the President, the State Department, and the Navy Department to bring the fleet back home. Roosevelt finally lost patience and early in 1941 ordered Richardson relieved. Nimitz, despite his lack of seniority, had some qualifications that made him a suitable relief for Richardson. He had shown himself a gifted administrator and was noted for making do with next to nothing. It was he who had built the submarine base at Pearl Harbor, using materials that he scrounged from East Coast naval shipyards. Evidently, if Nimitz found the fleet base at Pearl Harbor inadequate, he was the man to make it adequate, and to do so at minimum expense. Nimitz asked to be excused. He explained that he considered himself too junior to be Sinkus. Were he, in time of peace, to be jumped over the heads of a half a hundred more senior officers, he said, it would reap him a harvest of ill will that might impair his usefulness. He had no scruples about declining the command, since he knew that the alternate choice was his friend, the able Rear Admiral Husband E. Kimmel. Nimitz's rejection of the fleet command may have been, for him, the most fortunate decision of his career. Kimmel, in accepting the duty, took the temporary rank of full admiral, jumping up 31 numbers and doubtless earning the ill will that Nimitz had avoided. Moreover, he took command of a naval force that, as events were to prove, was both inadequately protected and exposed to enemy attack. There is not, however, any indication that Admiral Nimitz, in declining the command of the United States fleet, had any motive beyond the one he professed, lack of seniority. On the day that Admiral Kimmel assumed his new duty, February 1, 1941, the expanding patrol force became the United States Atlantic Fleet, and Kimmel's force, based at Pearl Harbor, became the United States Pacific Fleet. Kimmel thus became Commander-in-Chief Pacific Fleet, SINCPAC, but he also retained Richardson's old title of Commander-in-Chief U.S. Fleet, SINCUS. This SINCUS title was henceforth to be rotated among the three fleet commanders, but the title was to be exercised only when two or more of the fleets operated together or to prescribe uniform procedures or training standards for all United States forces afloat. Because Nimitz, as a bureau chief, was not directly concerned with diplomacy or military operations, he was not informed concerning high-level negotiations between the United States and Japan. He was not aware that American cryptanalysts had broken Japan's diplomatic code and were reading messages between the government and Tokyo and Japanese embassies and consulates in Washington and elsewhere. Yet, as a voracious reader of books, magazines, and newspapers, and a keen analyst of events, he was able to keep himself almost as well informed concerning Japanese moves as were the nation's topmost military and political leaders. In the summer of 1941, while Nimitz and his bureau were working overtime to meet the manpower needs of an explosively growing navy, the situation in the Pacific was deteriorating rapidly. When the United States began restricting sales to the Japanese of the oil they urgently needed to carry on their war, Japan completed its occupation of Indochina, thus acquiring bases that menaced Borneo, the Philippines, and Singapore. In retaliation, the governments of the United States, Britain, and the Dutch East Indies froze Japanese assets, thereby threatening to cut off Japan's oil purchases entirely. The Japanese then had a choice of three courses of action. 1. Induce the United States to unfreeze their assets and provide them with oil. 2. Terminate their aggressions and pull back their forces to the homeland. And 3. Assure themselves of a supply of oil by seizing the petroleum-rich East Indies. Because neither the United States nor Japan was willing to change its policies, informed observers expected Japan to execute the third option. As Stark had pointed out to Richardson in 1940, the U.S. fleet had been moved from the West Coast to Pearl Harbor precisely to deter the Japanese from such a move. By autumn 1941, however, it had become apparent that they were not going to be deterred, even at the risk of war with the United States and the British Commonwealth. Indeed, it appeared that, in order to protect the flanks of their southern advance, the Japanese might occupy the Philippines, Singapore, Hong Kong, and possibly Guam. Britain's deep concern at the growing crisis was demonstrated by the arrival at Singapore of the battleship Prince of Wales, the battleship cruiser Repulse, and other vessels, evidently as a further deterrent. Japan showed its anxiety by rushing to Washington a special negotiator, Saburo Karusa, to assist the Japanese ambassador and his staff in dealing with the U.S. State Department. President Roosevelt appealed directly to Emperor Hirohito to withdraw Japanese military forces from southern Indochina. In early December, American newspapers reported an assemblage of many Japanese ships in Cam Ranh Bay, on the southeast coast of Indochina. On December 6th, they summarized reports from British aviators of a huge Japanese attack force rounding the southern tip of Indochina and entering the Gulf of Siam. Like many thoughtful Americans, Admiral Nimitz doubtless studied the map and concluded that this fleet was headed for the Malay Peninsula to launch an attack toward Singapore. On the other hand, he did not suspect that Japan's only carrier force was simultaneously heading eastward for a raid on Pearl Harbor. Nor did any other American suspect anything of the sort, not the President or the Secretary of the Navy or the Chief of Naval Operations, and certainly not Admiral Kimmel, whose Pacific Fleet was the main target of the oncoming enemy carriers. Admiral Nimitz was spending Sunday, December 7th, 1941, at his apartment at 2222 Q Street, Washington, D.C. With him, besides Mrs. Nimitz, were his youngest daughter Mary, aged 10, his daughter-in-law Joan, and her daughter Frances. The two older Nimitz daughters, Catherine, then aged 27, and Nancy, 22, lived in a separate apartment across the hall in the same building. Chester Jr. was in a submarine operating out of the Philippines. After a late midday dinner, Admiral and Mrs. Nimitz, as was their custom, settled down to read and to listen to music. At 3 p.m., the Admiral turned on the radio to hear a CBS broadcast of Artur Rudzinski conducting the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. Almost immediately, the broadcast was interrupted by a flash announcement that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. Admiral Nimitz leapt from his chair. Hardly had he got his overcoat on when the telephone rang. It was his assistant, Captain John F. Shafroth, saying that he was driving to the Navy Department and would pick Nimitz up. The Admiral asked Mrs. Nimitz to call his flag secretary, Lieutenant Junior Grade H. Arthur Lamar, and tell him to get down to the department. Said Nimitz, as he went out the door, "I won't be back till God knows when." At the Navy Department, Admiral Nimitz conferred with members of his staff in his own office, and then hurried off for further conferences in Secretary Frank Knox's and Admiral Stark's offices. Knox had been talking by telephone to Admiral Block, Commandant of the 14th Naval District, whose headquarters were at Pearl Harbor. Block had described the damage he could see from his office window. The Oklahoma and the Arizona had been badly hit, he said, and the Pennsylvania and the Tennessee superficially damaged. The California was down on the shallow bottom, but could be raised. Luckily, the Navy Yard and oil reserves had not been touched. Admiral Stark, with the President's consent, had radioed the U.S. Navy's first combat directive to all commanders in Panama and the Pacific area: execute unrestricted air and submarine warfare against Japan. That Sunday, Nimitz felt as never before the awkwardness of a physically divided bureau, with its head on Constitution Avenue and its body in Arlington. In the late afternoon, he arrived for consultation at the Arlington Annex. By then, news reaching the Navy Department from Pearl Harbor revealed that there was a great deal that Admiral Block had not seen from his window. The Nevada and West Virginia and a number of smaller vessels, 18 ships in all, had been damaged, some beyond repair. Hangars and other buildings had been set afire. Nearly 200 planes had been destroyed, most of them on the ground. Americans killed and injured, chiefly U.S. Navy personnel, numbered in the thousands. To his old friend, Captain F.E.M. Red Whiting, the Bureau of Navigation's Director of Recruiting, Nimitz expressed his despair. "Red," he said, "we have suffered a terrible defeat. I don't know whether we can ever recover from it." Back at home, Nimitz's daughter Catherine had taken over her father's accustomed chore of walking Freckles, the family cocker spaniel. She used no leash, which she considered unnecessary in view of Freckles' sterling record for good behavior. Mistress and dog turned into Massachusetts Avenue, and there beheld an astonishing sight. On the side lawn of the Japanese embassy, a fire was blazing, and employees were lugging out boxes of official papers to dump on the flames. Crowds looked on under the watchful eyes of District
Sample complete. Ready to continue?